And don't get me wrong, there's always opportunity to continuously improve manufacturing processes because there's efficiency gains to be had at any given moment. Right? If I were to just draw a line in the sand and say, oh, well, manufacturing can't be improved anymore, that's just not true. I mean, let's go back to your John D. Rockefeller example. He won because he had the most efficient petroleum refineries at the lowest cost possible. But today's petroleum refineries are probably doing better than even he did back then. If people just throw out their hands and said, John D. Rockefeller has done this better than everybody else, we're never going to get better costs, so let's stop optimizing our costs. That's not the basis of competitive capitalism. Likewise, just saying that you're going to optimize your manufacturing cost does not result in the long-term outcome of you having the best embedded product cost possible.
Welcome back to the Clean Techies podcast, where we interview the top climate founders and VCs to get their best advice for you. In this episode, I chat with Vivis Kumar, CEO of MitraChem, the first lithium-ion battery materials manufacturer focused on shortening the lab to production timeline by over 90%, addressing the largest barrier to innovation, R&D, and scale-up speed. Vivis was a phenomenal orator in this episode, and if you take a second to learn about MitraChem, I often pronounce it MitraChem, but it's MitraChem, it's easy to see why. By combining their knowledge of iron-based cathodes and an AI and data-enhanced production capacity, they are able to manufacture quicker and more reliably than any of their competitors. We talk about how looking at running a startup like an engineering problem has led to his success, why iron-based materials are getting traction due to supply chain challenges, and how we observe that at Tesla, the shift from innovation to supply chain and manufacturing that's unlocked MitraChem, how AI has enhanced their production automation, longevity and outlasting the competition, looking for relentless curiosity in order to find the right people, how to keep organizational costs low, and much more. As always, thanks so much for listening and enjoy the episode. All right, Vivas, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm doing very well. It's nice to be here. Nice to meet you after hearing such wonderful things about your podcast from a good mutual friend, Mike Jackson from Earthshot Ventures, who is one of our earliest supporters and somebody I'm really thankful to have on our side as well.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I asked Mike, his episode would probably come about maybe 2 weeks before this episode, and I asked him, like, who are the best people in your portfolio that we should talk to, and you and MitraChem were on there, so the excitement is very, very much mutual.
I think he might have been confused, but I'll go ahead and take that as a compliment from Mike and make sure to correct his mistake, hopefully, by the end of this.
Why don't we kick it off? Who are you and what do you do?
My name is Vivas Kumar. I am the CEO and co-founder of MitraChem. MitraChem is focused on solving three problems. The first is speed, using an in-house AI advantage to significantly reduce the design build test cycle time to bring a new battery materials product from lab to market. The second is a focus on iron-rich battery material cathodes, which are safer, cheaper, and come from cleaner supply chains than your traditional Western nickel-rich solutions. And finally, it's to build scale with manufacturing partners for production of these battery cathodes in an Inflation Reduction Act compliant manner. We have been running the company for about 3.5 years now, and we have wonderful partners from around the world. Most recently, our Series B financing was led by General Motors, along with other strategics like GS Group from South Korea, TechMet Mercuria, Xeon Corporation, InQtel, the venture capital arm of the U.S. intelligence community, along with a few other financial investors. And we're using all of that capital and the 60 incredible people with whom I get to work every single day to go after a thesis on iron-rich cathodes that's focused on the fastest-growing segments of electrification and electric vehicles and energy storage for North America.
I want to call it for the audience that Vivas is actually a Toastmaster champion and a very, very serendipitous Toastmaster champion, apparently, on his first try. And I feel like you start to see that come through. So I'm super excited for this. You hit on a couple key things that we can definitely pull on. A lot of really, really key trends of today, AI for design, optimizing the processes of different industrial processes, but also iron-based materials, which we'll get into this, really talks on what you can do for onshoring, nearshoring, and strengthening your supply chains. So I think so many interesting key things to dive into there. With that overview, one of the things I am most inspired by is your journey. So I would love to start off by hearing, how did you start off being an entrepreneur in the first place?
Well, I never thought that this company would be the thing that I'm doing. I was actually obsessed with solving the problem of reshoring battery supply chain to the United States and transitioning to a more sustainable supply chain. And it just so happened that entrepreneurship was the vehicle to go and solve that problem. So I guess that's the first thing I'll say to any of you who are aspiring entrepreneurs is don't focus on building a company as much as focus on solving a problem that matters. And there's multiple different tools that are afforded to you to do that. Right? I've got plenty of friends who are just as interested as I am on solving problems in the battery supply chain, but they're choosing to do it in many different venues, right? Some of my former colleagues from Tesla, people who I work with still very closely, have chosen to remain at places like Tesla because the scale that you can get or the scale that you can accomplish from being in an environment like that allows you to have a very large scale and meaningful impact on the global product flow of materials. You know, I've got friends who are very focused on workforce development for climate-related jobs in the United States because so much of the type of labor that we need for reindustrialization in the United States has been lost for nearly two generations given the amount of manufacturing that's been outsourced in the United States. So there's plenty of different issues within the entire realm of climate, which is a topic that compelled me the most. It's the basis of the problem that I want to solve. And it was mostly obsession about the problem that I wanted to solve, along with the earliest backers that I had who approached me when I was a student at Stanford University and gave me the opportunity to get funded and build this business is what pushed me into being the CEO and founder of this company today.
So I would love to start off on the obsession with nearshoring and how that factored into this journey. So what did that early obsession look like? How did you go about exploring it?
Well, so I'm an engineer by training, and I'm very proud of being a member of the engineering profession. I will say it's a miracle that my alma mater even let me graduate with an engineering degree, considering how bad I was at class. But for me, it was never about the problem sets or the spreadsheets. It was a lot more about the manner of thinking about large-scale, difficult problems that sit at the intersection of bits and atoms, and working together with another team of motivated, inspiring, and intelligent individuals to go out and solve those problems. And because of that obsession with wanting to be an engineer and solving engineering problems, I looked at what are some of the realms in the world where engineering can make a real impact. And climate was at the top of that list. So that's what compelled me after engineering school to go to work at Tesla. It was a very different company than it is today. I mean, this was, you know, about 9 years ago at this point. The Tesla Model 3 had not even come out yet. It was still a relatively small sort of niche premium vehicle manufacturer with a valuation that people thought was absurd with this like crazy CEO who like tweets a lot. I guess some things have never changed. But, you know, at the time I thought this could be an interesting way for me to apply my engineering knowledge in a white hot space that's going to have a huge impact on climate. And through that is where I learned about the complexities and intricacies of the global battery supply chain. Now, batteries at the time were transforming into being a platform technology for energy storage across multiple different industries. And the supply chain was so heavily concentrated outside the United States, in countries like Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, and China, all of whom had concerted multi-decade efforts to industrialize around the industries of tomorrow. And have executed tremendously against those promises to build the supply chains that they have today. So in terms of reshoring to the United States, what do we need to do? Well, it's that same commitment to, is the same level of commitment that resulted in some of our East Asian compatriots who've become leaders in the battery supply chain that we need to evidence over here. Number one, recognize that we need to do reshoring as a matter of course for national security, but also as a matter of course for integrated full-stack product development for climate solutions in the United States. The second, then, is to figure out what are the elements that are needed within a variety of industries. Number one is the availability of the talent and labor. Number two is access to capital financing from multiple different parts of the financial stack, all the way starting at the very top, with angel investors and venture capital, all the way through to the very mature, like public equity markets and government financing. And then finally, have the will and determination to make the commitment necessary for the multiple decades that it needs to lead an industrialization effort of this front. That to me is what is the essence of being an engineer. It's going out and solving multi-decade problems that matter. And the challenge of reshoring battery supply chain in the United States, which is my chosen field, is just a manifestation of that promise.
Wow. That was a fantastic way of putting it. And I think the whole idea of aligning the key problems that are existing in the industry as well as the parts you need to solve it in such a systematic way. I think especially in leading up to the show, I was super, super impressed by all the things you had done, especially on the representation side of Tesla, being able to be there at the forefront a lot of these conversations. And it's very clear that that broader view gave you a lot of exposure. So you represented Tesla in their negotiations. And generally speaking, when it comes to materials, if you had exposure to raw materials like nickel, cobalt, lithium, what are the trends and challenges you're seeing with those materials that are making you go towards iron in the first place?
Much of the thesis that my company is pursuing today is based on the experiences that I had at Tesla. And specifically, it's back in the year 2017 and 2018, there were lots of difficulties for buyers of nickel and cobalt materials because of supply chain dislocations from government policy, from rampant speculation on the London Metal Exchange. And it was driving us crazy as buyers of these materials in an automotive like Tesla. If you work in an automotive and you are a buyer, you care about ensuring that you get costs to be as low as possible for as long as possible. The last thing you want is volatility. And volatility might as well be the middle name for nickel and cobalt because of the industry trends that they've evidenced over the last 10 years, not just because of, but partially in consequence of the rapid growth of lithium-ion batteries. So the last deal that I was involved with in my time at Tesla was the first time that they transitioned away from nickel and cobalt-rich battery chemistries as an exclusive platform upon which they built their battery technology and towards iron-rich. And now it's publicly known that over 50% of the vehicle portfolio of Tesla uses iron-rich cathode. And we saw that this trend was going to start happening with the other Western automotives and energy storage players as well. So when we launched MitraChem, we were really focused on the chemistries of the future. And we thought that the category of iron-rich battery chemistries would be where the most innovation and the most scale-up could happen. Both categories, innovation and scale-up, that are equally important to ensuring that we build solutions for the products of tomorrow and to stay continuously ahead of the customer's needs. And when we chose to double down on iron rich, it was a very unpopular decision 3 years ago because much of Western industry was still heavily focused on nickel rich. But now the tide has shifted because as they've seen more and more volatility in nickel and cobalt markets, as they've seen more supply chain dislocation, as they've seen more difficulty in acquiring the quantum of materials that they need for mass market electrification to meet the promises that they have made to governments, to consumers, and to their supply chain, they're seeing more and more the best de-risked solution is to go more towards iron-rich. So just connecting the dots, coming up with a thesis for a company like mine is not something that you do overnight, right? I'm giving my personal story on this, but my two co-founders, both are also battery industry professionals, both of whom have been in the battery industry for longer than I have been in this industry as scientists, and even in the realm of scientific innovation and engineering ingenuity, they saw themselves that pushing forward new battery chemistries alongside a scale-up mentality was what was going to be needed to push their own professions forward. And the amalgamation of their engineering and scientific knowledge and my having a commercial sense from seeing how purchasing behavior was happening in the real world by consumers is what came together to allow us to form the thesis around what this company has built.
We are excited to announce that we have launched a Patreon. You can find this newly linked in our Substack and audio platform descriptions. We are both really just so grateful for each and every one of you and wanted to create a way to interact with you and for you to support us on our journey as we continue and try to talk to the best people doing amazing things in climate tech. We do all of this on the time we can muster outside of our day jobs, so any support means the world. Now, gushing over, back to the show. Wow. And I think the thing that stood out to me about your journey, continuing on, going from your time at Tesla, you left at around the time that you could have started to see the shift in tide around moving towards materials that were not your standard, legacy minerals that you'd been used to. on that point in time, you went to do your MBA at Stanford's GSB school. One of the things that really stood out to me was you worked at Benchmark's Mineral Intelligence Group as a principal there at the same time. So I'd love to hear more about how that factored into the way you thought about the whole problem.
The Benchmark team is an amazing team. I had a wonderful time working with them. Simon Morse, Andy Miller, Casper Rolls, these guys are wonderful voices in the battery supply chain. And I still rely on their market intelligence quite a bit today. And going back to my time at Tesla, I relied on their market intelligence even back then to make my purchasing decisions. And so when the time came for me to take a little break from Tesla and go work on myself and improving myself by earning an education, the reality is I still had to find a way to pay for it. So for those of you who don't know, Stanford Business School is, I'm very proud to call Stanford Business School my alma mater. However, I must say that it is not the cheapest place to go to school. And I knew that I wanted to have as much optionality as possible after I graduated. So the best way to do that is just to relieve of yourself of student debt, right? I mean, these are just harsh truths in life that you might as well just put out there. So you can do one of two things. You could either go back to former employers who are willing to pay for the MBA, which wasn't really an option for me. Or the second is you can find a way to creatively pay for it. And the Benchmark team came to me and said, look, you have a lot of knowledge for the battery supply chain that could be very useful and helpful to industry participants. We would like to really give you an opportunity to build competency in the battery supply chain based on that knowledge that you've accrued. Why don't you come and do it with us as a principal consultant? And so I worked full-time at Benchmark while I went to school full-time at Stanford. Not really the best decision for work-life balance, but you know, we all make our choices, and I'm glad I did, because it allowed me to stay relevant and stay at the forefront of industry knowledge to keep in continuous contact and conversation with the principal decision makers across the battery supply chain, and to further hone my thesis around iron-rich cathodes as being a underinvested growth area for the North American market. Even before the Inflation Reduction Act was passed, even before the bipartisan infrastructure law was passed, just based on what I perceived as the commercial behavior of counterparties all the way up and down the battery supply chain.
What you said there, one of the things that really stood out to me was staying relevant in a field. And I know you talked about, you know, a primary driver being affording your education, but I think the strategic value you had about being a knowledge expert at the time that you were doing your education, me personally, when I was in college and learning from my education, I think one thing that's very, very clear is it's easy to become disconnected with industry. And I feel like we're building up to this point in January 21, when you decide to transition to becoming this full-time founder of the company you now run today. So how did you decide to pull the trigger then?
Well, I didn't decide, it was decided for me. So the Series A round at MitraChem was led by an amazing mentor of mine, Chamath Palihapitiya, who is a venture capitalist who's had a lot of early stage technology success here in Silicon Valley. And he essentially said to me, you know, all these ideas that you have about battery supply chain, you should solve them by building a company of your own, and I will help you do it. My firm, Social Capital, can incubate this business for you, and I'll lead a financing round for you. And when you get made an offer like that, you know, it's a pretty life-changing offer to be given an opportunity to build a company to solve a relevant and prescient problem that you've been thinking about for years at that point, when the timing was just right, given policy tailwinds at the same time. And so I decided to take the offer up. Social Capital was an incredible firm to work with. And, you know, off the basis of the incubation that we had over there, we went and built our own lab in Mountain View, California, and had multiple other funding partners join us on the journey as well. So it was a bit serendipitous for how it happened, but I really appreciate that Chamath gave me that push back then. And he's still a member of our board of directors. I still get to work very closely with him, along with the multiple other strategic partners that we've brought on. But the other strategic partners that are here wouldn't have been here if that first push that was given to me didn't happen.
So it was this combination of the right expertise and the right opportunity and the leverage that opportunity can bring, combined with some other macro tailwinds you're observing, the policies for one. Maybe you were also monitoring the turn of the tides with iron-based materials. I would love to dive into that in a second. But I think you were able to then use that to pull the trigger, aggregating enough knowledge and then finding the right opportunity based on certain things rather than just, okay, it's time. Like, let me just do it now.
To be relevant in this industry, a highly technical, very global network and information edge driven industry, which requires a confluence of skills in science, technology, policy, and commercial thinking, is not something that happens overnight. I mean, here I am. This is my 9th year doing work in the battery supply chain, and I still feel like it's the beginning for this industry, and I still feel like there's so much left for me to learn. And hopefully after I've learned, I'll be in the position where I'm blazing the trail for the rest of the industry. But we're nowhere close to that. Big engineering problems take decades to solve. If you think about the trajectory of lithium-ion batteries to get to where they are today, where we are today is a result of 7 decades of government-funded, defense-funded, industry, corporate-funded, academia-funded industrialization, global efforts to bring the lithium-ion battery from a technology concept, the idea of energy storage disconnected from a continuous power source, to being a ubiquitous tool that's powering this iPad that I'm using for this interview right now, this phone that I'm looking at right in front of me right now, the mic that you're holding in your hand, the TV behind you, right? I can name so many different devices that use a lithium-ion battery because of the compounding growth of this technology and its proliferation across the world over the last 7 decades. So who knows what the next 7 decades are going to be like for this technology? We don't know, but I certainly hope that the company that I'm wonderful, that I find the wonderful opportunity to build now, MitraChem, will be one of the companies at the forefront of building that future for lithium-ion batteries.
The parallel I'm thinking of here when I listen to this is looking back to like the robber baron era when Rockefeller built out the oil refineries in Cleveland. And this was actually ironically before automobiles had even taken real control of, you know, our transportation. And so that wasn't even a major use at that point in time. But he had recognized that being at the forefront of this innovation meant that with its growth, I can grow too. And so can my industry and so can my impact.
Look at the companies that can trace their lineage back to John D. Rockefeller that are still the largest companies and some of the most influential companies in the world today. These mega trends in technology intersecting with geopolitics, intersecting with a unique moment in human history where the circumstances are ripe for the technology to proliferate in an exponential pace around the world, happens only once a generation. Rockefeller was a good example. A very relatable example from our lifetime is actually internet-related technologies. And I believe that climate will be that next super cycle, which is why I'm choosing to build in climate now. Not only because it's an existential threat, but because it's an opportunity for abundance.
Please elaborate on that. What do you mean by opportunity of abundance?
Every single great society in the world has been built by the downward trend of cheaper electricity and energy. And by eliminating resource scarcity. This is the true promise of clean energy. Whether or not, for whatever political or scientific beliefs, you believe in climate change or think it's a hoax, you cannot disagree that you want to pay less for more energy. Who doesn't want to see their electricity bill come down? Who doesn't want to see their fuel costs come down? Who doesn't want to live a better quality of life with less money? This is the promise of clean energy and electrification. This is what platform technologies like lithium-ion batteries can do, especially in parts of the world that are lesser developed, where English isn't the predominant language, and where Western values do not govern daily life. We take for granted, living in the US over here, that when you turn on the light switch, there's a 99.999999% chance. That's a statistical truth, by the way. 99.99, like 6 9s.
Yep.
That can be solved with the proliferation of some of these clean energy technologies that are used to solve climate change. They're also used to lift humanity up across the world. So what I'm very interested in is not only how do we make a better technology, but how do we also proliferate that technology for humans to live a better life. The downward march of energy prices, I hope, will continue throughout my life, because that will be directly correlated to quality of life for humanity getting better.
like you said, most of this technology that we do and build in the United States doesn't yet affect a lot of the emerging markets and a lot of the population of the world. There's so much ground to cover there. And you talked about climate being at a forefront. One of my main inspirations within climate is the different types of financing, like you mentioned, the maturity of these financing markets and what potential that has for developmental finance.
So let's take India, which is the country where both of us trace our ethnicities to. And two-wheelers and three-wheelers are getting electrified at an alarmingly fast rate in India, which is bringing down the total cost of ownership. So that the average Indian person, considering this is a country with a per capita GDP 10x lower than that of the United States, giving an average Indian person the access to opportunity of owning their own transportation at a cheaper cost so that they improve access to services, improve access to employment, improve access to education. That's extremely inspiring. Batteries are making that possible through this electrification effort. That battery technology wasn't developed in India, but Indian companies and Indian people have said, okay, how can we adapt this technology that has clearly worked in other markets and localize it for ours in a way that benefits our society? I'm simply using India because I just happen to spend a lot of time over there. But you know, I was recently in South Africa and I saw the same thing happening over there, right? Africa completely skipped some telecom infrastructure build because of the cell phone. They'll probably be able to skip some grid infrastructure build because of solar plus storage or wind plus storage or hydro plus storage because of the proliferation of lithium ion batteries. In the long time span of life, when the initial industry research on lithium ion batteries was done by the Nobel Prize winners Stan Whittingham and John Goodenough and Akira Yoshino, they probably did not think that there's going to be an African youth who's going to have access to electricity because lithium ion batteries are getting cheaper 50 years from now. They were just trying to solve the problem of how do you have mobile energy units. But because the solution worked, and because the incremental gains compounded year over year for 5 decades, there were new applications that had never been imagined before. So I'm telling you now, even for batteries and for the idea of mobile energy units, we probably have not even thought about applications today that 50 years from now will be used, right? When we're going to go and build a colony on Mars, for example, how will we power it? Probably whatever advanced form of lithium ion battery. I'm just, you know, I'm pulling your leg a little bit, but I'm just tossing out that this is the curve of technology growth.
In planting those seeds, shifting to more nearshoring models allows you to seed some of that progress domestically and more reliably than if you're relying on these far out, distant, fragmented, potentially volatile, like you said, supply chains. And so providing the technology that can allow that to happen and be replicated is fantastic. I mean, you talked about taking models and replicating them. Ironically, Chamath, who you referenced in the beginning, I follow some of his work and his whole model about 80-90 and just taking technology and replicating it for emerging markets. I think that's exactly the thesis.
But what is he doing? So the scope of my relationship with Chamath is very focused on his position as a board member at Mitrachem. And all I know about 80-90 is what he has posted publicly about it. But if I could conjecture my personal opinion based on reading that work, I believe the problem that he's trying to solve is cost. He's trying to take the business models that have worked and reducing the cost tremendously to create greater access for those products and services to an entire segment of the human population that may not have had access to them in the past.
Hey guys, we need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show.
And it's the dogmas of speaking of biographies, like I'm an avid reader of biographies, try to listen to it as much as I can. What the great leaders always say is you can't control how prices rise and fall, but you can always control your cost.
Yes.
And so that thesis, I'm sure, is also at the core of a lot of this strengthening of supply chain and delivering things that are just more reliable and easier. And I think that's
at some point, you stop focusing on innovating and you start focusing on supply chain and manufacturing. That is a very big shift. And specifically, you stop focusing on manufacturing, you start focusing on supply chain. Because once you've optimized the manufacturing efficiency gains as much as you can, The only way in which you can control your costs is to control your inputs.
And so you think that the transition from going from not even manufacturing, but everything else to supply chain is the point at which you've optimized your processes enough?
That's exactly right. And don't get me wrong, there's always opportunity to continuously improve manufacturing processes because there's efficiency gains to be had at any given moment. Right? If I were to just draw a line in the sand and say, oh, well, manufacturing can't be improved anymore, that's just not true. I mean, let's go back to your John D. Rockefeller example. He won because he had the most efficient petroleum refineries at the lowest cost possible. But today's petroleum refineries are probably doing better than even he did back then. If people just throw out their hands and said, John D. Rockefeller has done this better than everybody else, we're never going to get better costs, so let's stop optimizing our costs. That's not the basis of competitive capitalism. Likewise, just saying that you're going to optimize your manufacturing cost does not result in the long-term outcome of you having the best embedded product cost possible. Because at some point, the incremental margin savings possible from manufacturing efficiency gains will decrease per unit of effort that you have to put in to get it. So then what do you have to do? Active supplier management and supply chain de-risking to reduce the potential for volatility of pricing in your supply chain is what you're going for.
We've covered a lot of the brilliance on the material side, how that plays in global geopolitics, and also how that relates to supply chain optimization and business strategy. That was one side of the coin. So it's fantastic that we have another really, really revolutionary concept to get into. And that's how you're using novel technologies related to data and AI and automation to help with your production. You know, in doing the preparation for this episode, I came across that your three ways of doing that is, one, the exploration of the synthesis design space. Two, the rapid feedback of material design from in-house data. And three, the accelerated cell quantification. What I want to know is how and at what point in time did you discover that ML and AI can be a core tenet of your business and be a real value differentiator along the way?
Let's take the last decade's battery materials companies, and many of them took 10 plus years to get to a product that was commercial ready. At that pace, we're never going to beat climate change. We need lots of new products out there in the world faster, ready to scale up faster, that are continuously improving according to the specs that customers want. So in the same way that we wanted to bring down costs at large-scale production, we also want to bring down the cost of resources and innovation. AI is kind of like a hypey buzzword. We're recording this episode at the end of Q1 2024, which I think will go down as the quarter with the most venture capital investment in AI like ever, more than the last like 15 quarters combined or something ridiculous like that. And I would say the concept of artificial intelligence has been around for a long time, even before this VC hype cycle around AI. And the idea is that you use two different types of methodologies. One is learning, one is inference. So learning is, and the names imply what you're trying to do, right? Learning is aggregation and understanding of data. Inference is based on the aggregation and understanding of that data. How do we solve for a certain hypothesis? Or how do we downselect which hypothesis even matters? If you can get to that point of figuring out what hypothesis even matters, that's when you're really rolling on having an AI flywheel and having an exponential decrease in resource costs to go and solve problems. Scientific experimentation is simply the idea of generating as many hypotheses as you can, ranking them based on the value-risk trade-off, relentlessly going after the highest value, lowest risk hypotheses, or continuing to de-risk hypotheses to drive greater value, and then going and generating even more hypotheses to create a better flywheel so that you can get better products faster, optimizing around certain criteria that matter. The criteria that matter for lithium-ion batteries are cost, energy density, cycle life, and safety. So every scientific hypothesis we run in the lab is all about how do we decrease costs? How do we increase safety? How do we increase energy density, right? I can keep going on and on about this, but it's pick a criteria, figure out how you want to optimize it, generate scientific hypotheses and experiments to optimize, and then go and relentlessly pursue them with as minimal resource cost as possible and minimal time cost as possible. So the AI tools that we have built internally as our proprietary advantage allow us to rapidly downselect which hypotheses matter and to determine which hypotheses deserve the most resourcing. This is no different, by the way, last point that I'll make on this summit. What I'm saying now is not innovative. You don't need, and with full respect to my two very gifted and decorated co-founders who had the initial thesis around this, You don't need a Stanford PhD to say the things that I said. However, it is the confluence of the thinking around how to accelerate the innovation process and the understanding of battery materials is the inherent advantage that we have at MitraChem, thanks to the vision of my two technical co-founders, around the implementation of AI tools, which they've seen succeed in other industries like biotech, like semiconductors, like other specialty chemicals fields over here in lithium-ion batteries.
So being at the cutting edge of two, what you called innovation edge technologies, when did you decide that right now is the right time where I say, okay, I'm going in as an AI company. I want to take on the hype. I want to take on the responsibility that means for incorporating this and telling my employees that this is what's up next for us.
To be clear on this, we're not an AI company in the ilk of many of the companies that are very successful right now pursuing AI theses. AI is an in-house enabler for us to get to better battery materials products, which is the core product of this company. Scalable iron-rich cathode active material for energy storage and electric vehicles that are Inflation Reduction Act compliant are what we are going for. The proprietary AI advantage is an enabler to help us get there. Why? Because I come from a commercial background where I saw exactly what were the bottlenecks in supply chain for battery materials during my work experience at Tesla, married that commercial understanding with the scientific and technical capabilities of the other team members with whom I work, and proceeded on the path of building a product-focused company, because that's what we believe would be needed by the customers in this industry. And in order to go and solve climate change, a key part of our mission. AI is simply an enabler to get there, but the confluence of bits and atoms is what's needed to solve our core mission here.
I feel like we've been able to trade back and forth dogmas that are very, very key and relevant to your journey. I'm curious to kind of pull back the curtain a little bit. You referenced the internet, the growth of the internet being a major, major inspiration. But I'm curious, who have been your inspirations along this journey? It could be people, it could be trends, but what do you feel is your North Star?
Well, my North Star on this is that, as I said earlier, engineering is a multi-decade challenge. You have to pick a very difficult problem and go out and relentlessly solve that problem. And instead of talking about one person, I want to talk about an industry and the key players in that industry that have informed the way that I think about being a CEO in my company. If you look at the last 30 years of semiconductors, you see the same trends that are going to play out in the next 30 years of lithium-ion batteries. So the giants of that industry, people like Andy Grove, people like Jensen Huang, and Morris Chang. I could keep naming executives, but basically go look at your executives of major semiconductor leaders around the world. Those who have simply outlasted their competitions are the ones who are now the global leaders. Like, let's take Jensen. Jensen's in the news a lot right now because NVIDIA is doing an amazing job. But when Jensen started NVIDIA, there were 10 other companies that looked like his. Every 5 years, there was a company that was going to knock out NVIDIA. And here they are. They simply just outlasted the competition. So longevity, companies with longevity, business leaders with longevity are the ones who inspire me, right? I gave a few examples. I'll give you another example. Jeff Bezos really inspires me. I'll tell you why Jeff inspires me. At the 25th anniversary of Amazon, Jeff had 11 direct reports. Guess what was the average tenure of Jeff's direct reports at their 25th anniversary?
I'm going to guess 10 years.
22 years.
Wow.
So you want to talk about longevity and outlasting the competition? He built this incredible leadership team that just stayed with him the entire way. And there's plenty of other examples like that out there. But I'm giving a publicly recognizable example because I'm highlighting something that's not really highlighted about him in usual course of business parlance, which is some of the most successful companies in the world are built because of the confluence of technology cycles with global megatrends, but also companies are built by people. And usually it's people who have worked together for decades who go out and get it done. Right. Andy Grove was at Intel for decades. Jensen has done this for 30 years now. Morris Chang has been in semiconductors for, this is a seventh decade in semiconductors. Think about where semiconductors were. World War II had just happened and semiconductors were a niche industry. And now it's one of the geostrategically most important industries. His company is one of the most geostrategically important companies, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing. This is seven decades. Same time span at which lithium-ion batteries went from a concept to where they are today. So my goal is to just follow the example of these leaders who've just completely outlasted their competitions. Because if you outlast your competition, if everybody else goes bankrupt and you're the last one left, you automatically win.
Oh, you win. And it's so cool. I think it even is even more personified when that whole hype trend around what Sam Altman said about NVIDIA, give me, I think the order was $7 trillion and I'll take on NVIDIA. It shows you the scale and the moat they've built just by being where they are.
With all due respect to Sam, it's not just the money. It is the knowledge, the embedded culture, and time plays a huge role. So if you gave him $7 trillion, I don't think he can just go and beat NVIDIA off of that. There has to be a multi-decade compounding advantage that he needs to build. And given the moat, the defensible moat and positive flywheel that a company like NVIDIA has built for themselves, by the time Sam gets up and running with that, NVIDIA will be even further along, right? So props to Sam on all the successes of OpenAI and the long-term career that he has had in Silicon Valley for financing and being an active part of multiple different companies that define the consumer and industrial landscape in which we operate today. But simplifying it to a simple dollar number, I don't think is really fair to the successes of somebody like NVIDIA.
Totally. And it's almost a shame to say, but we're nearing the end of the episode. On that thread, I really want to round it out. One of the main inspirations I'm going to walk away from this episode is the idea of longevity and outlasting your competition. And I think it's not as simple as going at it. There's some techniques around how do you successfully last for that long. So I'd love to ask you, how do you think about increasing your longevity and outlasting your competition?
Just like how prices can fluctuate, but costs must stay low, I think about what are the ways in which we can keep organizational costs low. So something, and I'll say this, this is a little relatively controversial thing for me to say, but you know, I would love viewer comments on this idea. If you look at the S&P 500, the number of employees per $1 million of revenue as a statistic is one of the fastest declining numbers of any corporate stats, any corporate financial stats. It's controversial because it conjures up a lot of debates about the value of labor in a time of increasing automation and AI. But what that says to me is, if you hire the right people and you keep them adequately incentivized and motivated, you don't actually need a large team to accomplish most of what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, I think back to my experience at Tesla. So I really appreciate Elon, the opportunities that Elon gave me, the opportunity that I had to spend a lot of time with him, learning from him and seeing one of the greatest entrepreneurs of our time operate. Yeah, the guy says crazy things and tweets crazy things, but there are rockets in space, there are cars on the road. There are chips and brains, apparently. What this guy has done is amazing as an engineer. And one of what I learned from Elon was this whole concept of you just don't need that many people if you pick the right people and you keep them adequately incentivized and motivated. And I think back to my time doing battery supply chain at Tesla. Our team was very small. There were like six of us doing this for the whole company. And one of my colleagues from there is now the head of commercial at our company here at MetroChem. So, you know, going back to this whole concept of having long-term business partners. And I think back to that experience and what I want to apply over here to MetroChem, it's how do we find the right people? Not just how do we go out and hire people? Because if you find the right people, then the productivity of the entire organization can improve. So going back to your original question of like, how do you build the company around this thesis? Reduction of organizational cost is not, by no means am I sitting here and implying like, oh, I want to keep my salaries. No, no, no. That's the opposite of what I'm saying. Okay. Because I did say adequately incentivize the right people to be there. I'm saying, how do you keep the organizational cost low? How do you keep the friction low? How do you keep the overhead low? How do you keep the number of touch points for a decision to be made low? How do you keep the communication within a team as frictionless as possible? Every single individual element that's added to a puzzle increases entropy within that puzzle.
I think the parallel that I'm seeing here is you talk about some of the early engineers in Silicon Valley, and they're called the 10X engineers. But looking for the right people is not an exact science. But everyone has their own opinions, and I'm sure for tricks of the trade, you definitely know some things that you look for. So I'd love to hear that. What are some things you look for in the right people?
Relentless curiosity is number one. There is, in the same way that John D. Rockefeller did not just sit on his laurels and say, okay, I have the best cost in the industry, right? It was, okay, how do I get to even better costs? Okay, how do I do it again? How do I do it again? How do I get to even better costs now? A relentless curiosity around continuously improving yourself and setting the bar higher to conquer new challenges are inherent, innate characteristics of certain people that have a desire to outperform the wildest expectations set of them. These are characteristics that I look for in the people that come and work with me. Some people have them, some people don't in the general world. It is very difficult to find people who are this innately curious and inherently motivated to go after large goals. But once you find them, hold on to them forever. You can ask the question about literally everything in life. How can this be done better? Now, the flip side of that, Sumail, is over-optimization, right? Because you want to make sure you channel your resources and your energy towards something that gets the highest bang for buck possible on your time. So if you've optimized something to the nth degree and the amount of time that you need to spend getting it to n plus one is equal to getting something else to do a 50% improvement in the same amount of time, you do the latter. So prioritization is necessary. And it's a thin line between obsessive compulsion and optimization for improvement.
And I think that's the thesis behind Pareto's example, 80-20, a concept we reference 80-90. And I think that's what's going to help you guys succeed. Look, I love this episode. I think I'm going to be thinking about this for many, many days to come. Honestly, before we close, I only have one last question for you. Are you a Rockets fan?
I am indeed a Houston Rockets fan. Fortunately or unfortunately is up to you. But there were, you know, the Hakeem Olajuwon glory days will return to Houston again, I'm very sure, in my lifetime.
I think we're on the up and up. There's definitely some good players. Shangoon to look forward to. Jabari Smith Jr. I think we have a great team ahead of us. And you talked about investing in people. We'll see where that goes.
The only thing that I want to do in my entire life, in a business standpoint, other than running MetroChem, there's only one thing that will take me away from this company, is the opportunity to own and operate a sports team.
There we go. There we go. I love to hear that. All right. Thank you so much for coming on. Where can the audience find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Vivaswat Kumar. You can find me on Twitter, VivasVK7. You can find us at MitraChem.com.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sumail. Appreciate it.
If you've made it this far, thanks so much for listening all the way through that fantastic episode. This is right after Fresh Reaction. I feel like there were so many cool things that were talked about that I had to do it right away. And for this takeaway section, I would love to divide the three points that I'm going to make into people, and namely people in the version of inspirations. If you listen to the episode all the way through, you definitely know why. So the first is Leonardo da Vinci. And I think he represents the relentless curiosity that we talked about here. Being at what he called innovation edge industries, where you're constantly dealing with new information and building the future of our planet, you have to have a really, really, really strong desire to learn and utilize that knowledge. And I feel like I saw that through him understanding what he needed to know, and then at the very exact right time, pivoting that into tackling a problem. He spent time not only observing the different problems, but building up his own knowledge, making sure that he had the skills to tackle the industry. And I think that's very, very emblematic on the curiosity side about willing to learn whatever you need to learn to tackle a problem and looking at it that way. That, to me, felt a lot like Leonardo da Vinci. The second is John D. Rockefeller. I mean, I feel like I've referenced him in a few videos, and I think the thing that was clear was cost effectiveness. being able to control your costs and knowing that to a fault. I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs that we talk to, as fantastic as they are, they don't always spend a lot of time thinking about, okay, how do we get our costs as minimal as possible? And actually, the interesting reason is because they're not yet at that stage where they can think about that. That's why a guest like Vivas is so unique, that he's been able to get to this stage and have such an articulate vision of his supply chain. Keeping your costs low, and I think his point about organizational costs, that's something everyone can do, which is investing in the right people to make sure that you will be the most cost-effective for your innovation. The last is Jensen Huang. Admittedly, this is a very, very recent person, so this person's legacy is still out there. But the thing I took away from that and the semiconductor industry as a whole is outlasting your competition. I was told the other day that it's good for us to think about our lives as 70-year careers now, not in the term of we're working until we're 90 years old, but if you're thinking in terms of 70 years, each year in that 70 years is very, very small. It's not quite as meaningful as, for example, someone on the younger side like me feels like it is. And so if you're thinking about, okay, if we live to about 80 now, in, you know, 20, 30, 50, 40, like however long many years, you're going to be living to 90. So if you think about what that means from working from the age of early 20s all the way until you're 90 years old, outlasting your competition becomes even more important. The kinds of things you need to invest in to make sure that you are staying in the competition are immense. And it's very clear from talking to Vivas that he had a very, very strong sense of how he's going to continue working at this problem. He has the respect for the veterans who have been in this problem, and he's going to keep going in the direction of how do I survive the macro trends and be the winner of the whole thing. I think that was like an incredibly strong point. And it's something that when he referenced the semiconductor industry, it was already a parallel that I felt, but I think it even more increased my conviction. Ultimately, a really, really fantastic company, a fantastic guest. And I am so excited that we could share this with you all. Anyway, that's been the takeaway section. Let us know what you think. Share this episode with your friends. I think it was one for the books. So anyway, till next time.